If you're involved in high-performance engineering, think aerospace, Formula One, or even just building a really robust industrial motor, you know the terrifying truth. Sometimes the smallest, simplest component holds the key to catastrophic failure. And nothing is more deceptively simple yet microscopically complex than the spring. We're not talking about a spring snapping suddenly, though of course that happens. We are talking about the slow, silent killer that undermines long-term reliability. Stress relaxation. Imagine a critical spring, like an engine valve spring, under a constant compressive load. Over time, it slowly but surely loses its load-bearing capacity. It shortens, it sags, it just stops doing its job, and suddenly the whole system can fail. So today we're doing a deep dive into the very atoms of high-strength steel to understand why this happens. We're going through a foundational study from 1980 that wasn't just content to document failure. No, it set out to decode it, using what were then some pretty revolutionary techniques. Our sources focus on two material titans: the classic workhorse patented steel spring wire, you might know it as music wire, and its proposed replacement for really demanding services, the 17.7 PH stainless steel. Our mission is to find that common thread of, let's call it, microstructural instability that links these two very different materials and makes them so vulnerable to relaxation.
And that mission, it required some real scientific bravery at the time. The goal was to move beyond just macroscopic testing. It was to formulate a deep, a predictive understanding of relaxation resistance. And that meant meticulously tracing the changes happening right down at the atomic level.
So, tracking phase shifts.
Phase shifts,
yeah.
How dislocations, defects in the crystal actually move, and crucially, how solute atoms segregated during low-temperature heat treatment.
And to see something that small and that subtle, I mean, the researchers had to use the most advanced tools available.
Absolutely. We're talking high-resolution techniques. Things like transmission electron microscopy, TEM, and even field ion microscopy, FEFM, and atom probe techniques. These were the tools that let them observe, literally atom by atom, the very defects and chemical shifts that ultimately decide a spring's fate.
Okay, let's unpack this, starting with the old champion, patented wire. It sounds like a generic
It
name,
does.
but it refers to a very specific process that gives this high-carbon steel wire its incredible strength and ductility. What exactly is patenting? It's not just a registration, right?
That's a great question, and it speaks directly to the process. The term patented actually comes from the original manufacturing technique. Steel was heated up and then quenched in a bath of, say, molten lead or salt. This carefully controlled cooling process is all about creating a very fine, very specific microstructure before the wire is even drawn.
So it's all about the recipe and the structure.
It is. Chemically, this is a high carbon steel. We're looking at between 0.55% and 0.85% carbon. But there's a critical control measure here: contamination. Nitrogen has to be kept incredibly low. I mean, below 0.0008%, because if you have free nitrogen floating around in there,
it just ruins everything.
It massively reduces the toughness and it messes up the grain structure you need for that high strength.
So they're controlling the ingredients down to trace amounts, almost like a chef. But the secret sauce, as you put it, is the structure created by that cooling process.
Exactly. The structure is called perlite, and perlite is a layered composite, you see. It alternates between soft ductile ferrite, that's iron, and hard brittle cementite, which is iron carbide. We're talking layers or lamellae. And what makes the structure so strong isn't just the presence of the hard stuff, but the proximity of those layers.
The interlamellar spacing.
Precisely. The closer you can jam those plates together, the smaller that spacing, the stronger the overall steel becomes. The tensile strength increases almost linearly as you shrink that spacing.
So the whole point of patenting is to cool the steel just right, to get those plates infinitesimally close.
That's the game.
That makes a lot of intuitive sense. You're building miniature internal barriers,
Yeah.
and then the engineers step in and apply the second phase, brutal cold drawing. This cold drawing is the main method of achieving that final strength. You're progressively reducing the diameter, which causes this massive mechanical refinement. The study showed this can make perlitic wire up to 5 times stronger than a similar ferritic wire. It's that combination fine structure plus intense mechanical work that gives it its legendary status.
And now we have to zoom in, because that cold drawing process fundamentally rearranges the internal lattice structure. During this work hardening, the material undergoes massive plastic deformation. And it's not just the soft ferrite giving way. The deformation is so severe in fine perlite that the cementite plates themselves actually have to bend and deform.
Wow, even the hard, brittle parts are being forced to change.
They are. But the most important consequence for long-term failure is what happens in the ferrite, the formation of a dislocation substructure. Dislocations are just defects. Think of them like wrinkles or slips in a perfect crystal lattice. Cold work creates millions and millions of them.
So if a dislocation is a wrinkle in the carpet, cold drawing is like shoving that whole carpet into a tiny corner, creating a massive tangled mess of new wrinkles.
That's a perfect visual, and at higher strains, that messy tangle actually starts to organize itself. The dislocations cluster into dense walls, and they create these small, distinct compartments. We call them cell structures, or subgrains.
So the material is literally building its own internal scaffolding. I love that idea.
And that scaffolding is the strength. The flow stress, so the material's resistance to further deformation, it becomes strongly tied to the diameter of these cells.
Okay, so there's a formula here. The stress is proportional to what? The inverse square root of the cell diameter.
Or sometimes just the inverse. But yeah, the takeaway for engineers is simple.
Smaller cells, much, much more strength.
Exactly. You get huge rewards for making those cells tighter and smaller.
But this process must be incredibly sensitive to external factors. Temperature, for instance.
Primarily temperature. The research clearly showed that if you draw the wire at room temperature, or even super cold, say, minus 73 Celsius, you get a much higher final tensile strength.
Compared to drawing it warm, like at 150 or 300 degrees C,
right.
Why is the heat just allowing those wrinkles to straighten themselves out?
Essentially, yes. Higher temperatures allow the dislocations to rearrange more easily. It's a process called recovery. It prevents the formation of those tight, dense cell walls we need. You need that intense, low-temperature mechanical trauma to lock in the highest possible strength.
And that brings us directly to the time factor, this delay mechanism that can sometimes help and sometimes hurt. It's called strain aging.
Right. Strain aging is a phenomenon where the material's flow stress actually increases after the deformation is complete, sometimes just by letting it sit, or you can accelerate it with a low-temperature heat treatment.
And this is where the chemistry comes roaring back in.
It is. The primary culprits here are those tiny, mobile, interstitial solutes.
Carbon and nitrogen.
Exactly. They have just enough thermal energy to migrate through the iron lattice, and they actively seek out the most stressed, most imperfect regions, which are the dislocations and those cell walls. They cluster there.
They're forming what the research calls cut-trail atmospheres.
Correct. Think of those carbon and nitrogen atoms, like tiny pieces of, well, atomic superglue.
Sticky patches.
They migrate to the dislocations and chemically bond, effectively pinning them in place. When you then try to stress the material, those pinned dislocations can't slide, and the material becomes much stronger.
So there's this tension. Cold work creates the strength, the cells, mm-hmm. but it also creates the potential weakness, these sites, for the solutes to cluster. And strain aging is usually bad if you want to cold form the steel later. It makes it brittle.
It does.
But paradoxically, managing this process is the key to improving the final strength and fatigue life of the finished spring. If you can lock those dislocations down, they can't move later when the spring is under load.
And that precisely brings us back to the core problem, stress relaxation. The long-term loss of load-bearing capacity isn't some mysterious force. It's fundamentally the result of these microstructural changes happening over time. The dislocation substructure is shifting. That residual stress is being relieved by the slow, thermally assisted movement of dislocations that weren't sufficiently pinned to begin with.
So if your old engine spring starts to sag after a few hundred hours, it's not just wear and tear. It's those atomic structures getting unstuck or rearranging themselves because the forces are causing the dislocations to slide past their pinning atoms.
That's the mechanism. And the research used analytical stress relaxation testing, which compares this behavior to creep. They're distinct, of course. Mm-hmm. Creep is deformation under constant stress. Relaxation is loss of stress under constant strain. But both deal with time-dependent movement of internal defects.
Here was the biggest practical finding they pulled out for patented wire. How do they actually fix the problem?
The breakthrough was showing that the most significant improvement in relaxation resistance came from applying a strategic low-temperature heat treatment, or LTTT. You apply it to the wire or the finished springs before they ever go into service.
So you're pre-aging it, in a way.
You're forcing the atomic structure to settle down and lock in its strength in a controlled environment first. You encourage those carbon and nitrogen atoms to migrate and stabilize the structure. It's far better than letting engine heat or the operating environment do it unpredictably, which is what causes the service failure. It's like buying structural insurance.
That is just clever management of a microscopic flaw. You're using the very mechanism that can cause brittleness strain aging in one context to stabilize the material for long-term use in another. Okay, now, let's turn our attention to the Challenger. 17.7 pH stainless steel. This was investigated because the patented wire, despite its strengths, was simply failing in these increasingly demanding service environments. They needed an alternative.
And 17.7 pH is a completely different animal. It's a precipitation, hardenable stainless steel. Its strength doesn't come from cold drawing and perlite. It comes from a multi-step thermal process that creates and then grows tiny hard particles inside a soft matrix.
The pH stands for precipitation hardening.
That's right. First, you get it into a soft, workable structure. Then you expose it to carefully controlled temperature cycles. These cycles first transform the crystal structure, often from austenite to martensite, and then they cause specific alloying elements like aluminum and nickel to combine and precipitate out. They form these ultra-fine strengthening particles like niall.
So if patented wire is strengthened by tightly stacked layers and pin defects, 17.7 pH is strengthened by atomic gravel scattered through the structure that stops movement.
A great analogy. Two radically different approaches to strength.
And yet,
the study of 17.7 pH showed it suffered from the same core malady, stress relaxation failure. Its performance decayed over time, just like the patented wire.
But the mechanism must be different. If it's precipitation hardened, what's unstabilizing the structure? Is it not the dislocations anymore?
It's the instability of the strength mechanism itself. In 17.7 pH, relaxation doesn't come primarily from dislocations sliding past carbon atoms. It comes from the instability of the precipitates. Over long periods at surface temperatures, those ultra-fine strengthening particles can change. They can dissolve or they can coarsen.
Coarsen. So the tiny particles merge into fewer, larger particles.
Exactly. And when those strengthening precipitates coarsen, they become far less effective at blocking deformation. The material loses its internal gravel. Its yield strength drops.
And that leads directly to stress relaxation and loss of spring load.
Precisely. The research was all about tracking the stability of these precipitates, trying to find the optimal aging temperature to make them as resilient as possible.
That is a remarkable synthesis. Two materials. One strengthened by mechanical deformation locked in by solutes, the other by chemical precipitation. And yet both are undone by the same fundamental physics. The tendency of their internal scaffolding, whether it's dislocation walls or atomic precipitates, to become unstable and rearrange over time.
Accelerated by heat and stress.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener, managing systems that rely on these invisible forces? The key takeaway is that high-performance spring behavior is an incredibly complex interplay of foundational chemistry, initial processing, and that crucial post-processing.
And if you take one thing away, let it be this. Failures like stress relaxation stem directly from microscopic instability. If you can't stabilize that internal structure managing dislocation movement or preventing precipitate coarsening, you will lose performance. It doesn't matter how strong the material was on day one.
And this really underscores why the researchers needed those three high-resolution techniques back in 1980, while three different microscopes.
Because they needed to see different things. TEM was great for seeing the dislocation substructure, the cell walls, but to see where the carbon and nitrogen atoms were actually segregating and to track those ultrafine precipitates in 17.7 pH. For that, they needed the power of field ion microscopy and, critically, the atom probe to identify chemical composition, literally atom by atom. They had to watch the atomic superglue being applied.
It makes you realize just how sophisticated materials engineering had to become just to keep a simple spring working reliably for years. They had to invent new ways of looking at materials just to solve the problem of a sagging engine valve.
Absolutely. The structural integrity is entirely an atomic phenomenon.
Now, the research noted that alloying additions in these BCC metals, like the ferrite and patented wire, can significantly influence the formation and size of the dislocation cell structure. We've talked about carbon and nitrogen doing the pinning. But if we want maximum long-term stability and relaxation resistance in next-generation spring steels, the kind that truly never sag what specific alloying components beyond the traditional ones might you explore today to create even more stable, tighter cell structures that resist movement over decades? That research question, born from this foundational work, is still driving innovation in material science right now.